This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies,
but we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights
and get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. All right. Welcome to the podcast that gets older while the rest of the internet stays the same. This is Moody Derek, and joining me for Bold today are...
Do you imagine how many people out there are freaking podcasting right now, man? Just going at it. This is getting too bad.
This is Ferris. Mitchy. We're looking for you, pal. You're fucking dead. Can I swear on this?
Yes.
Anyhow, your ass will be purple by the morning, pal.
Hey, and this is Chris, and all I'm saying is that if I ever start referring to this film as one of the best films of my life, remind me to kill myself.
Oh, boy, we're coming out swinging, aren't we? All right.
You hate our freedom.
In this episode, we're discussing Dazed and Confused, starring Jason London, Joy Lauren Adams, Rory Cochran, Mila Jovovich, Adam Goldberg, Anthony Rapp, Marisa Ribisi, Cole Hauser, Wiley Wiggins, Renee Zellweger, Parker Posey, Nikki Kapp, Ben Affleck, and, of course, the man himself, Matthew McConaughey, directed by...
Everybody.
and directed by Richard Linklater. Oh, gentlemen,
you could more quickly name people who are not in this movie.
It reminded me back of when we were doing Nashville last year. It's like that was like 20 people I had to do the cast for, and I'm missing like some of the other, you know, some of the other major character actors that are in here. It's like this is just the baseline of the ones that are recognizable. Right. This is a massive cast. And I was going to talk about this a little bit later,
yeah.
But holy crap. This is like one of those casts that you know, you come back to like 20 years later, like we are right now, and you start realizing, holy shit, all these people are in the same damn movie. And then they would go off and do movies together. Like,
you know, I wish I would have thought of this 10 minutes ago, but if you would look at all the people in American Graffiti versus this, I wonder how the numbers stack up. I mean, all respect to that movie, which is by all accounts an American classic. This has got to have more good performances in it.
Oh, that's, I don't know, man. That's kind of...
That'll be the homework assignment, listeners. Email,
move
tweet,
up let American us know. Graffiti.
I'll just say right now, this, man, there are so many movies that this is kind of giving homage to, but it feels like its own thing a little bit. And this is one of those things about this movie. I'm actually surprised it took me as long as it did to actually watch this movie. Believe it or not, I actually stayed away from this movie for about 10 years, primarily because I got this mixed up with another movie that came out about the same time called The Stoned Age. And that looks so awful. And I, for some reason, thought it was Dazed and Confused. And so, I was back when I was starting Netflix, is like I was putting together my first real queue, you know, putting them all in. And
The Stoned Age, while not without its charms, is not this movie.
Yes. I don't think I've ever heard of that movie, so maybe
it is. I don't know the exact chronology, but it sure as hell plays like a desperate, cheap, low scale, low budget knockoff of this.
Actually, if I'm not correct, it came out 1 year later, or maybe 2 years later from this one. So I have a feeling that this was actually meant to kind of emulate the cult success of Dazed and Confused. But I hadn't heard of this until The Stone Age, and I got it completely mixed up. And that movie looks so bad, I just, like, I don't
You're
want
not
nothing to do with it. So But out of curiosity, what was your first time watching this movie? When was the first time you've even heard of it?
Oh, God.
And I want to start with you, Ferris.
You know, I was on my way out of college as this was coming in. I was surprised that it's 1993. I could have sworn 96, but and now that I'm thinking about it, 96 doesn't make sense either. I had a lot of damaged brain cells at that point. I was kind of transitioning from college, in which I had a fraternity experience, to kind of extended post-college state in which I was not always on the straight and narrow either. So yeah, this came in at the tail end of my college experience, and we just, being in a fraternity culture, as you can imagine, we just gravitated it.
Wait a second.
Gravitated to it, loved it. I guess pretty much everybody who's been in every kind of organizational culture situation, whatever you want to call it, looks at this and says, oh my God, that's about me. Whether it's a football team or a baseball team or a swimming team or a softball team, or I'm sure there are church groups out there that are more liberal and watch this and think, that's exactly what it's like. Pastor Tim is exactly O'Banion. Oh my God.
I'm just going to say.
So yeah, I mean, this very much hit me where I live. And plus it picks up on a lot of things that I like too. But yeah, I came from it as as the person who had lived through an experience of initiation and a very tight group, et cetera, et cetera.
Ferris, I'm just going to say that when you said frat house, I saw your future and involved a toga party. Just saying.
Now I do teach college, and I'm absolutely certain that part of what has brought me to be a professional educator is karma for things that I did as an undergraduate. So I pay for it early and often.
Nice. All right. So what about you, Chris? When was the first time you were familiar with this film?
God, I feel like I've known about it forever because I was...
Did you see it on first run?
Came out, I guess. So, no, I've seen bits and pieces of it for years. I never watched it all the way through until last week. So, yeah. I just didn't have any interest, I guess. So
we got our
Know if I have watched it all the way through since the 90s, but it's been on Stars pretty much every day all summer. So I've seen parts of it a lot lately, but I literally could not tell you the last time that I watched the entire movie, despite the fact that if you would put a gun to my head, I could probably repeat it all for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about you, Kent? When was the first time you've seen this movie?
I want to say that I'm thinking 96, 97 time frame on video, which makes me wonder if this movie didn't come out on VHS until about that time.
No, it came out about 94. It was part of that. Okay. Yeah.
Well, yeah, if I was on my way out of college, it would have been 94-ish.
I don't remember really seeing it till later, unless the cultness of it didn't catch up.
Well, there's a story.
There's a when we used to get together like once a week for a couple movies, there was a guy who insists on certain movies being watched, mostly for the hot chick and of the week that he had a crush on.
Yeah. And got a few of those.
This was one of those movies because of who's in it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we gotta watch this because Joey Lauren Adams is in it and blah 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 blah. And if I remember right, we watched this about the same time Chasing Amy came out.
Nice.
That's why we were watching
96, if I'm not correct.
Yeah. Which would make a lot of sense. But mm-hmm.
All right. So there is a story about the reason why this movie kind of bombed when it hit the theaters, but it gained a cult status once it hit VHS. It was kind of the same way as Shawshank Redemption in that sense. But believe it or not, the thing was is that Richard Linklater had made Slacker, which we talked about, I want to say, about a couple of years ago. This movie kind of was a pretty big indie you know, it was an indie film festival sensation. It went to all the film festivals. People loved it. You know, big Hollywood producers, James Jacks and Sean Daniel, who you'll know from like things like Mallrats and The Mummy, the Brendan Fraser one. They had Tombstone, which I believe came out about the same time, if I'm not correct, 93. They had seen Slacker, and they gave him an opportunity to throw a pitch. And he threw a pitch about the last day of school in the 70s and kind of this movie. And so they decided to, I think, give him $10 million. And he went off and he made this little indie film out in Texas. Well, the thing is that Universal did the one thing that you really shouldn't do with comedies. And I wonder if any of you know what that big thing you should never do with comedies is.
Test audience?
Yes.
Ah.
And the test audience had absolutely no idea what it was that they were watching. And so Universal threw it to their little mini dog, Gramercy Pictures, and they released it in the 5 theaters in the United States, which bummed out most of its cast because they thought they were going to be big movie stars. And since then, they went back to their commercials and their TV shows. And until, of course, it hit VHS. And then all of a sudden, college dorm parties and midnight circuit screenings all happened. And the film blew up. I want to say about 94, 95. And now it's considered kind of a cult hit, a rite of passage type movie. You know, something akin to the likes of a certain movie that we talked about last year with a particular individual that's on the podcast with us tonight. And apparently he's been enjoying some of the same stuff that the cast was enjoying.
Could you hear
that? I thought he was dying.
Did you hear that? I thought I had my mute on. Sorry.
Okay. Uh-huh. Was the cast enjoying it, or the characters enjoying it? It's a key question.
Well, believe it or not, if I'm not correct, actually, I don't know if they actually had any of that on set, although there was a McConaughey there, so...
That's true. Yeah, all right.
Just saying, you know, I think I smell something from his trailer, and I see bongos. We're going there. All right. But needless to say, so this was kind of a cult hit type of movie. And then, of course, Richard Linklater would go on. And, of course, this massive cast of even like the extras became big things. Like, if you notice a particular actress that her name isn't even in the credits, and it's Renee Zellweger. You know, she was just happened to be.
Where was she at?
Wow.
No, she was one of the girls that were in the blue truck, and she comes back at the party, and I believe she's still around the blue truck. But yeah, she's around there. Now it's kind of easy to mistake her for Joey Lauren Adams because they do kind of look about the same.
Of them in the same movie would be like negative and positive energy touching each other.
Oh wow, that's
you know something that I do have here. I don't have to jump into it all at once, but I have a running tally of a lot of the major actors and characters and their best other role in another movie or production. Because a lot of the people here obviously went on to big things. Some of them yes, some of them no, but a lot of them did interesting things.
Many of them did. And I actually bought this on the Criterion Blu-ray, and the behind the scenes stuff about the movie and kind of where the cast had gone since has been extremely impressive. I cannot recommend the...
Yeah, that's a good feature.
Criterion. Even the commentary was really good. I was really impressed with the commentaries. But I absolutely recommend if you are a fan of this movie, and it sounds like we don't have all fans here, so we're going to definitely get an interesting perspective mix. But we'll get there. We'll get there. But if you are a fan of the movie, I would recommend it. Before we get into the movie proper, I want to talk about the opening shot because I have to admit, for such a simple shot. how impressive. It's like the perfect match of just the right image with the right song. Can we agree about that? That is a really good way of just starting, right? You know, you have a fade in. You see an orange, if I'm not correct, is orange Trans Am, if I'm not correct. And you have it kind of cruising a parking lot to Aerosmith's Sweet Emotion, right? I mean, that's a pretty, I mean, just the sound of the engine with the sound of the song and kind of just have that, you know, kind of sets you up for your environment. Is that not an impressive opener for something so simple?
Yeah, it just cruises in.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's just, go ahead, sorry.
It's the cool guy in school.
No, it's not. If I'm not correct, the orange is, that's Dawn's charger.
You're supposed to think it's a cool guy in school, but it's the impression.
Well, I mean, Dawn is not exactly like Mr. Nerd or anything.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he is a football guy, but he's not our main protagonist here. And, you know, out of all the...
Is there a main?
I believe there are, but I don't think that this is a movie that kind of rallies around, you know, main protagonists. But there's definitely focal characters, and part of me do want to kind of go back to American Graffiti and kind of refer to like certain characters being like certain others, like when we get to Pink, that's our Richard Dreyfuss, right? That's our focal character, the one that we're kind of our everyman, right?
Nah, Pink. I see Pink and Mitch being central in the movie. You know, I see it as the story of Mitch's initiation as a younger being.
Okay, so you say you Mitch know, is the Richard Dreyfuss, and perhaps maybe Pink is the Ron Howard.
You know, I don't know American Graffiti well, so I can't come up with a good one. But you know, Mitch is the young guy coming into the tribe, you know, the future hero, and Pink is the one on his way out.
Well,
not on his way out, but he's where Mitch is going to be in 3 years or 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, well, I don't know. I don't even think that there's that kind of parallel because. We don't really see kind of cycles. We see kind of the seniors or what I'm assuming are kind of the up and coming seniors kind of initiating the freshmen. I think you have that kind of cycle type of thing. But outside of that, though, we don't see a whole lot of circular elements. We don't see kind of a tie back with the exception of like one scene. And it's not even a big scene at that.
If Mitch is the star pitcher, and the potential, he is the potential starting sports guy compared to Pink as his.
Yeah, but he's not going to be the jaw. He will be a star athlete, it looks like, but he's not going to be Dawn. He's not going to be a big burly jock.
No, he's going to be a different kind of jock, but you know, in a couple of years, they're going to try and walk up to him and say, sign this pledge, just like it.
And Pink is certainly not an archetypal football player, but he has a good arm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have to be a big guy because he's that kind of quarterback.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what I really appreciate about how they set up the characters is that, like, even with Dawn is the closest we get to a stereotypical jock. And can we just go ahead and just say it right quick? Are we looking at Stifler's dad? Seriously, I mean... This guy, he looks almost like Stifler, doesn't he?
Wait, does he put? No, he doesn't. What?
No. Stifler's
it's 20 years later, so which it's a timeline.
You're not wrong.
Stifler does. But.
I mean, if you look at the other guys, I mean, I forget the man. I mean, O'Banion, definitely a jock. Mm-hmm. Cole Hauser, Benny.
Yeah, Benny's a jock.
Definitely a jock, not a sophisticated guy. Who was the guy with the soul pole? What was his name?
Crap. It's like, oh my god! I know.
Certainly doesn't seem dumb, but he is. I'm guessing he is more of a jock type.
But
we establish that the city, town itself is in Texas?
Yeah.
Or do we know?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if it says Texas, but it just is Texas.
No, it never says Texas.
It is sports heavy.
I always got
it is
the
sports
sense
heavy.
That,
so.
Well, but yeah, but we don't see football. Yeah. I mean, we know about the football team, but I mean, this is the end of the end of the school year, 1976. I'm sorry, my brain is all over the place. But no, I mean, for all we know, this could be anywhere. This could be Arkansas. Yeah. This could be Virginia. This could be anywhere. Because they said that they're going to Houston to grab Aerosmith tickets, so it would be Texas.
Right.
That's
yeah.
right. Such a throwaway line.
Right. But it tells us where we're at, so it's San
Jose. So it would be East Texas. So yeah. That's. But at the same time, they don't really make it very clear that this is Texas. This could be anywhere USA kind of thing.
It's not a very rednecky Texas, so a lot of the just common universal things come through.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we should go ahead and put it out here. Richard Linklater modeled this town on a town called Huntsville, which actually I live pretty close to, which is where he used to live. So I don't think it was shot there. It doesn't look familiar, but if I'm not correct, he shot it near Austin. But yeah, for the most part, I mean, it kind of has a small town vibe. You know, it has kind of the local hotspots that you would find in a small town. I also love the fact that it feels 70s without screaming 70s, right? It has that kind of worn and kind of lived in feel to the film.
Yeah, and for some context, in 1990, the Beastie Boys dropped Paul's Boutique, which is an album that had a real retro 70s kind of vibe. And it was sort of ridiculous at the time because we were just getting over the 80s and that 70s thing was ridiculous and dead and buried and laughable. And then 2 years later, it was back in full force. Bell bottoms and weed. I think that's one of the things that makes this movie very accessible. You know, so we were in the middle of a 70s revival, middle of a weed revival. People were wearing, the five-pointed leaf plants all the time. So a lot of the imagery, a lot of the dress code, even though it was 20 years later, was not unfamiliar. You know, certainly felt very contemporary.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that was the next question that I kind of had was, why this time period? Why 1976 of all things? I mean, they make a big deal out of it being, you know, this would be the summer of the centennial. I love the little throwaway lines, you know, like with the teacher saying, "Well, why you're having all that patriotic stuff? Don't forget that, you know, this was all about slaves and taxes." It's like, you know, just see little things here and there, you know, little signposts talking about Happy Birthday America and stuff like that, that you see throughout the film, and yet they don't play a big part. They don't, you know, make it such a blaring thing that this is what it is. It just kind of is dangling in the background a little bit.
Well, you're more of a Linklater fan than I. How old is Linklater?
Linklater,
he was born in 1960.
Okay, so this was. I mean, I say that a lot of the time that filmmakers tend to do certain things just so they can put it in the period when they were young. Donnie Darko, there's no good reason for that movie to be made in the 80s or set in the 80s, except that it lets them use certain songs, you know. And this, I mean, that makes sense that this would have been the age that Linklater was when he was making it.
Yeah. I definitely got the feeling like that he's pulling from recollections. But one of the things that I was really impressed with, and I guess part of me is that I saw this after I saw Slacker. My out of curiosity, Chris Ferris, have you seen Slacker? I know that Ken has.
I have not. I have not. That is a gaping hole in my cultural literacy.
What about you,
Chris?
Yeah. All right, Slacker is possibly my all-time favorite Linklater film, and that's saying a lot because I, yeah, you put it right. I am a huge Linklater fan. I didn't intend to be a Linklater fan, but after watching his repertoire and constantly just being impressed by his work, with the exception of Bad News Bears, there's no way that you could. That was a mistake. I honestly don't think he actually directed it. I think that he just put his name on there to save some poor soul's career. It's like, you know.
But, hey, one for them, one for you, you know.
Yeah.
Make that money.
Well, technically speaking, the thing that always gets me is whenever I think about any movie that was made between 2003 and 2012 is the fact, or no, 2015, is the fact that he was making another movie throughout that entire damn time. It's like... That's the thing that just gets me. It's like I can't think back on Bad News Bears and realize, like, while he's doing that, he's also thinking about the next part of this movie that he's doing in quiet, like over here, which of course would turn into Boyhood. But yeah, I am a huge fan of Linklater's. And one of the things that I really appreciate about what he does, especially with films that he's, because you could tell that he is trying to find something organic in his movies. You don't get the sense that he is structuring things too much. He wants to get something earnest and honest from his actors, from the position, or you know, from the environment that he's in. He's trying to get something natural, and it kind of reminds me of Robert Altman a lot with what he does. And especially here, the conversations, the way that people talk, the way they interact with one another, it feels honest. It feels like these are people that have known each other their entire lives, you know, that they've had history together, you know, that when the movie was, before the movie started, they knew who each other were. And when the movie was over, that they were going to know each other pretty much for the rest of their lives. Or
do you have any idea, having watched the Criteria Edition, do you have any idea how much film they shot? I imagine there's got to be like a cut of this movie that's 48 hours long.
He said that his rough cut was about 3.5 hours long. That was his rough cut. And I could definitely see that. And he said that was one of the hardest things was to cutting this down. But the thing was is that unlike other films of this nature, like if we ever talk about Mallrats, that was an instance where, you know, a director basically was just dragged, you know, kicking and screaming to cut his movie the way that it was wanted, which was against what he was kind of going for to begin with. But here, Linklater makes it very clear that this was the vision that he really wanted for the movie, and he's extremely proud of the final cut for this film. He wouldn't add any scenes back if he could. Although if you ever do see the Criterion, there are a shit ton of deleted scenes, and they're good.
Is there an extended cut, or do they just exist as one scene at a time?
It's just deleted scenes. I think they basically just said, okay, I'm proud of this cut, but if you want to see some of the stuff that we dropped, here are the best parts. And the thing is, especially is when he was talking about it in the behind the scenes stuff, is that the actors would come up in the middle of shooting and go, hey, we got a scene that we want to do. And he's like, okay, well, let's do a setup right quick. We'll do it and then we'll get back to it. And of course, that drove his crew insane because they'd already been working 24 hours a day. And he's basically telling, okay, just hold it for a second. We're going to do this right quick and then we'll come back. Needless to say, his crew was about ready to lynch him. And there were a lot of trees for them to lynch him. But at the same time, though, that's what I love about his work, especially like with this one. And one of the reasons why I kick myself for waiting as long as I did from seeing this, because as I'm watching this film, like even like the school stuff, because I love 24-hour movies where you have a scene, things that happen within a 24-hour period. And here it's like we start off, they go to school, we see how the last day of school is. I love kind of the fact that it's kind of lazy, no one's really wanting to do anything. I love the fact that even the teachers are that way. It's like,
like they don't care.
That one teacher with the bow tie is like, You hear you have like the seniors threatening to do bodily harm to the new freshman, and the teacher's like, "This is good."
Yeah,
like probably enjoying a little revenge.
If they've lived in that town their whole lives, it probably happened to them. God knows how long this tradition's been going on.
Yeah, we don't know.
They even say that. I mean, they even bring in that line. Isn't it weird how everybody is supportive of this and nobody cares? It's like, yeah, that's small town weird traditions.
That's Adam motherfucking Goldberg. I'm sorry. I'll tell you right now, the first time I saw this movie and I saw Adam Goldberg, like, what is he doing in this movie? There is no way that a guy like this would be in Texas. It's like, he just screams East Coast. Right?
He just emerged. I don't know.
I mean, he's
just a guy. Just a guy who wants to dance.
Yeah.
I love that line. I love that. That crew, the three nerds. Okay, can we compare it a little bit with maybe 16 Candles? Like the three nerds in 16 Candles with these three nerds? You know, is like the way that they connect with one another, you could tell that they're kind of the outcast. They're their own crew. They're so uncool that even the uncool kids don't want to be with them, right? It's like, but at the same time, they just have this natural order about them, and you know that they're able to have, you know, they're able to kind of associate with one another in a way that's, you know, kind of familiar, right?
It seems like with some of these kids, they should be playing D&D and not doing.
Well, I mean, this is 76. I mean, was D&D big in 76?
Not for, it's only 2 years old, like a year or two old at this point.
Well, this is small town Texas. So, and needless to say, it would have been seen as the devil's work.
Not until the 80s. That doesn't
this
really
is Texas.
Hit
till, as soon as it comes out, it's the devil's work. You have to prove probably, that it's not the devil's work before.
It would probably be with some of these kids looking at it. That's a bit of math. Can we get away from the math for a second here?
Like, can you throw a ball? Like, no. All right, then it's not worth it. Fine. But I love that this dynamic between these two guys and this girl. I mean, and first off, let's just talk about Cynthia. You know, the redheads. That is some red hair, right? I mean, holy crap. Flames in the dark.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and Cynthia, played by Marissa Ribisi, sister of Giovanni Ribisi.
Twin sister of Giovanni Ribisi. They're twins.
Yeah. So here's something that occurs to me. Are there any loners in the movie? I mean, everybody in the movie is in some kind of group, right? There's no just one person flitting around doing their own thing, right?
Well, maybe. I mean, technically, we'll get into it when we talk about Wooderson. He's the closest to a loner that we have, but you know, he's kind of like the Dalai Lama of this group, right? I mean, he's by himself.
Well, he certainly came up through that system.
Everyone just gravitates towards him.
Yeah, now he's kind of he kind of rose through it, and you know, as you said, he went off into the mountain, and now he's able to return as the wise elder.
Yeah, hanging out with high school kids and hitting on the teenagers.
Yeah, but I mean, my point is that everybody is integrated into society to some point. Even the people that aren't part of the larger society still have a social group that they form with them.
Well, I kind of took it as being a small town that, you know, you really can't afford to be a loner in a small town because you depend on each other too much. And the community, especially back in the 70s, I'm pretty sure they would almost insist that you be connected some way, somehow into the community, even if it's so much as, you know, raising a little hell. At least you're interacting, you know.
Right. You know, so that's a big part of what this movie is about, is the society and people initiating the young blood and coexisting with each other and how these social groups interact.
Yeah. I mean, if you take
and
it
from
like,
time to time, Woodward and Bernstein are going to come into contact with Clint. And that depending how you play your cards, may or may not work out so well.
That's one of the things I love about Linklater's style is people don't just like walk into one another; they collide. You know, there's a lot of collisions. There's a lot of people that kind of, you know, that they gravitate towards one another, and it could be volatile, or it could be insightful, or it could be just weird. You know, like the sense of like the whole, you know, doing the trash cans on the mailboxes, and how that kind of brings us to, you know, where the guy comes with the 45. You know, it's all these collisions that are occurring with all the characters. Is like,
yeah, for the last day at school, I mean, and it is Texas. I haven't been there, but I see it in movies and TV. For a movie about the last day of school, a lot of people get guns pulled on them.
Well, that is Texas.
It is the 70s. Come on, man.
You know, let me put it this way.
Not saying it's not plausible. I'm not saying that.
Let me put it this way. If you can go 5 years in Texas without having a gun pulled on you, you're an anomaly.
And you know, it is interesting that there is enough of a sense of community there that these people can not only pull but fire guns at each other and not take it as a grave, literal existential threat. It's just what happens. You're a little bit out of line. We're going to pull a gun on you. Okay, I'm not going to call the police. We're not going to make it up.
I've got stories. I've got stories.
This is a community.
Wow.
Let's just put it this way, and maybe Chris is the odd man out here on this one, but I've had a gun fired at me. So
I have not.
And
so, yeah.
But it's interesting that you mentioned the collision. You know, part of what is interesting about this to me is just the, you know, not to sound like Woodward and Bernstein, like Mike, not to be talking about dominant male monkey motherfuckers, but it is interesting how on a level this movie explores just the animal socialization of people. I mean, the scene where they have one little pacifier left over.
Yeah.
And the girl who's handing them out looks at the group of three girls.
Yeah.
And out of three of them, she just kind of, I don't know if Kay Christine Hinosa, I don't know if she has the right smell or she's emitting the right pheromones or the right look. But the girl looks at three girls and decides, "Yeah, you're one of us. Come on, let's go."
Let's be honest here. Cool? She's definitely the cutest of the three. I mean, trying not to sound too creepy about that.
They're not uncomely. But I mean, just out of the three of them with nothing to really base it on, just whatever social animal instinct she has says, "You are one of us, come along."
Mm-hmm.
And later on, when Clint looks at Mike, he's not one of him. You know, he's not entitled to all the same rights and privileges that somebody with a similar, yeah, position or stature in the community or somebody coming from the same background might have. So he gets something of an ass beating.
Well, Clint is a psychopath, so there is that.
he was provoked.
Well, yeah.
He was provoked.
Yeah, he was provoked, and Mike got the ass kicking he deserved. But at the same time, it was an ass kicking that he knew he was going to get. He wanted that ass kicking. He was angry, and he wanted... especially after that first encounter, what Clint did, what the way that Clint embarrassed him and mocked him, you know, was one thing that, you know, it was kind of that feather on the camel's back kind of thing. He had taken so much, and you could tell that he has built up so much resentment of this place, of this small town, of the people in this small town. And this was just the final straw. And he wanted a justification for that hatred. He wanted to get beat so that he could say, "I am right to hate this place." And that's exactly what he got. And, of course, I love the fact that after he gets his ass kicked, I mean, even Pink is willing to kind of, you know, is kind of willing to joke with him and, you know, call him Muhammad Ali, just to, you know, is both kind of, you know, having fun with him, but at the same time, kind of taking the sting out of it a little bit, right? Or no pun intended there. Or at least that's kind of how it felt, was like, you know, that these people have grown up with each other enough that they know what, you know, what buttons to push, which ones that they, you know, even like between Clint and Mike, they knew what buttons are going to push. They know who each other are. They are, you know, it was going to happen at some particular point just because of their personalities and the fact that they're stuck with one another, you know, in one high school campus or one small town. You know, that was going to happen, right?
Right.
And of course,
he may have miscalculated just a little bit, but it played out pretty much like he saw it.
Yeah. And I mean, and let's be honest here, Clint ain't got nothing on O'Banion. Let's talk about O'Banion. Come on. Let's do this.
This man is psychotic.
Ben motherfucking Affleck. Oh, man.
Yeah.
I'll tell you right now. If I'd seen this movie before I'd seen anything else of him in it, I would have told you that this was a star. He owns his scenes in this movie. He has that cockfire kind of confidence. He does
absolutely nothing to take that edge off either. I mean, he absolutely dives right into it. In a fearless way. I mean, he's a young actor. He's on the rise. He's a good looking guy. You know, a lot of people at that age might worry about coming off as a dick.
Well, that's the thing is that, and this is one of the things I really love about what Linklater said about the way he cast the so-called antagonist. And the thing is that he doesn't really like using that term with these characters, but like O'Banion and with Clint, you know, the ones that are kind of the more hostile and the more antagonistic type characters. Even Parker Posey, to an extent, we'll get to her in just a little bit. He wanted them to be obnoxious, but he wanted the actors to be able to give them where you kind of sympathize a little bit. It's like when Affleck gets his comeuppance, we're glad he got it, but at the same time, though, we also kind of feel bad for him just a little bit, you know. Because
there's nothing to feel that he didn't deserve it. He certainly went out of his way to be in that situation. But man, you know, when I look at him get hit with that paint and I think about everything that will have to be undone to get the paint off of his hands, hair, car seats, car steering wheel, it's still, you feel bad for him.
Yeah. I mean, it's a comeuppance that is earned, but at the same time, though, it's because I think that also what it is that this was a tradition. What he's doing is a tradition that others have done. Yeah, he takes it to an extreme. He does go a little overboard, but it's not as though he is someone that earns nonstop hate. You know, you don't look at him and go, this is a total piece of shit. I'll never, you know, I hope that something really bad happens to him. You want him to get his ass kicked. You know, you want him to get, you know, a comeuppance, but you want it to be something that he's going to lick his wounds and he's going to come back, probably even a better person, you know, or, you know, maybe one of those things like 10 years down the road, if he runs into, Tommy again, they'll laugh about it. It's like, yeah, remember that time you pour paint on me? It's like, but it's one of those things that'll be like way long, like the rest of the summer, you better watch his ass. But, you know, later on, it'll be something that they can laugh about later. You know,
I'm positive that in his mind, he is not doing anything out of line. This is what seniors do. And maybe, okay, he's a psychopath who's coming through it a second time and is a little bit more adept at this ritual than he should be. But in his mind, he's not outside of the lines.
What I think it is, and I think I think that Chris kind of brought it up in his opener, which is for O'Banion, this is the best years of his life. It's not going to get any better for him. he's not going to go off and become something bigger. He's probably going to be working in the, you know, in the repair shop right next to his old man after, you know, he graduates. This is his time to shine. And I think it's, in fact, if I'm not correct, he's the one that they say is going to be coming back for a second senior year.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, this is, you know, he's trying to keep it going. You know, he's not letting go, as we'll see with another.
Yeah, you have to wonder if he is there on purpose or not. You know,
I'm sure that you can tell he's having way too much fun. He's enjoying it way too much. You know, this is a Van Wilder of small town Texas. Yeah, I threw it in there. I said it. I'm not taking it back either. But, you know, but I guess at the same time, you can compare O'Banion with Wooderson. And Wooderson is, you know, he's kind of the same thing, right? He does hang out with high school kids. He's way too old to be hanging out with them. Although, ironic enough, he was actually younger than many of the high school kids portrayed in this movie, which is kind of a weird thing. But at the same time, though, you could tell that he is the elder statesman. You know, he's the friend that high schoolers, especially in the small town, kind of need. You know, someone that is kind of able to differentiate, okay, it's all cool, it's all good, nothing, you know, we'll just keep on living, you know, we'll just keep going. You know, that kind of statesman, but at the same time, though, there's something kind of pathetic about him. Just a little bit, right? He's, you know, especially like when he says that, you know, high school girls, man, you know, they, you know, I keep getting older and they keep staying the same. I mean, there's something really sad about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's funny, but creepy and, yes, sad.
You know, it's like, but the thing is, like, it's not really creepy because he doesn't lech off people. I mean, even when he's hitting on Cynthia, and he's full on hitting on her, right? Anytime that they're locking eyes, like you can tell he is wanting a piece of that. And but at the same time, though, it's not creepy. It's just, dude, she's young, man. She's, you know. But at the same time, though, you could tell that she kind of is into that. So it's one of those weird things. Like, where does that line draw in this, you know, in this town? You know, is this acceptable? Is this something that?
Yeah, 1976, man. There were not rules and mores yet. You know.
Well, I mean, everybody's drinking at 18. I'm pretty sure statutory rape is around. well, they. There's some states that didn't touch those laws until late.
Well, this ain't Utah, 90s. This is Texas. But I know. I apologize to the great people of Utah.
And cultural attitudes can override the law in some of these small towns anyway, so.
But yeah. You know, we talk about O'Banion kind of owning every scene. What do we think about McConaughey? I mean, this is ultimately his breakout role. This is the move. This is the film that got him Lone Star, that got him A Time to Kill, that got him, you know, the big name, right? So, what do we think about this particular performance? And I want to start with you, Chris, because you weren't so keen on him in Lone Star.
I guess I wasn't really impressed with them here either. So
really,
yeah.
So I mean, what do you like the character? Is this the character that maybe it was at the performance or the character that you had a problem with?
I don't really relate or remember any of the characters based on their performances. I only remember them because, you know, they became bigger actors later on. I don't really connect with the film at all. That was my biggest issue.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen it? On weed?
No, I don't smoke. Maybe that's the issue. So
I don't think that's either, an inference for this entire movie. So
neither do I.
Yeah. Wait. Well, you actually probably got tested for your job. No.
Yeah.
maybe 20 years ago. I maybe knew some people who did.
Okay.
But yeah, anywho, moving along.
Yes.
Chris.
Well, what about you,
Chris? Chris, this didn't fire for you on any level.
Did what?
This didn't fire for you on any level? Like, you didn't respond to it?
Sorry.
It was a chore to get to the movie through the whole thing for me. So, yeah. It was,
did you like anything about it?
Were there any lines that were impressive? Any characters? Any situations?
No. There really wasn't. Huh. I didn't laugh. I didn't. It was not an enjoyable experience. So,
well, let me ask you this.
I'm not a.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say I'm not a big Linklater fan. So.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Was there anybody that you in this movie that you were surprised to see turn up?
I mean, it is surprising to see Matthew McConaughey or like Ben Affleck starting a movie like this. I mean, that's kind of cool. I mean, the cast is impressive. I'll give it that. But like, I just, beyond that, I don't care. Is that bad?
All right.
Come on. What about you? What do you? What were your impressions of Wooderson?
You know, it's a little bit weird, but in some ways he reminded me of me. Because for a while when I was in college, I worked fast food, and they kept throwing me on the closing shift of the high schoolers. So I'm in second nice. Year of college with the high school, and it's like some
maybe don't go into too much detail here.
Thing there where it's like
that's just limitations. I'm pretty sure it's okay.
I'm hearing them with stuff, and I'm like, it sometimes it would be the older statesperson that isn't a manager that they can talk to. Sometimes there's like, that just go away. Like, go away. So it was that weirdness, so. And I could go, all right, all right, all right.
It was odd,
but yeah. It's, hey, that was me 20 years ago. Actually, that was about this time this movie came out, so.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I want to talk about the characters that absolutely make this movie for me. There's three, actually, that in my opinion, are, in fact, the greatest parts of this movie.
Okay.
Let's start off with Slater, the stoner.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Okay. It's weird because I never associated Slater with Rory Cochran. I've seen Rory Cochran before.
Whoa.
And you're so totally, it's just the hair.
That's
it's
Rory like, Cochran. Are Rory you kidding Cochran me?
With such long hair.
Wow. And he looks so.
Hey, pardon my clicking, guys. I got to pull up the IMDb page for this.
Yeah. That is. Whoa. He's. I. What?
Yeah. The guy is a pretty big character actor. But the thing is that I've seen him in a lot of stuff, and I mean,
so Empire Records, that's him, Lucas.
Yeah.
Wow. I did not know that. I mean, I've known both of those movies the entire time, and I never connected the two. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, just keep going through the IMDb. He's got
I don't recognize a lot of these. Hearts War, CSI, a lot of TV acting, steady work. That's good for him. 24, Day 7.
Oh, come on. Public you've seen Enemies. Oculus. Come on.
I haven't seen Oculus, but wow. He's even. Yeah.
No, he's. I mean, like I said. I mean, you understand. I'm a big movie guy, so I don't expect people to pay attention to the character actors that I pay attention to. You know, it's like you have to understand. I was a huge fan of actors before they became big in a lot of instances. But here's just. I mean, he's just one of those guys that constantly comes up. He's a really good character actor, And just to see him with the long hair, and the thing is, like, I didn't associate with him until this time around when I noticed his name. It's like, wait, where's Roy Cochran? And I was like, oh, that's him. Like, shit, I didn't realize that. And I like the, and this is a great character. I mean, he's got a lot of funny lines. He's a very boisterous personality. I especially love his history lesson on the history of George Washington, which is awesome.
Martha had a bong for him.
A bowl. He was like,
oh, yeah. It was, yeah, man. Like, oh, come on.
Oh, God. No, he was awesome. It was like, you know, completely wrong, but completely awesome. But, no, I just, but.
Well, no, he had the perfect stoner thing going. Because every stoner thinks all of history is about getting high.
Well, it's like everything
and
is about weed.
And that's what he's doing.
I mean, this is a guy who wears the five-leaf clover on his shirt. I mean, he's making it very clear what he's all about. You know, he is the Uber fan. And I love the fact that, you know, he's one of those guys that is just a peacemaker. I mean, he's going to probably be the Wooderson when Wooderson finally grows up or when someone runs him over with a car. You know, he's going to be the next Wooderson, right?
You know, no, Wooderson was, you know, dominant. I don't know if he was the alpha male monkey motherfucker, but he was definitely like a jock, an athlete, a smooth, suave guy, you know?
Yeah. Well, his exchange with the officer tells me that officer was in either the class of right near him or in the same class.
Yeah, they played ball together.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, though, that if you go back 10 years, Wooderson would have been the same person that Slater is.
If you have Slater however many years later doing the shit that Wooderson does, people are going to look at him creepy, and that would be an issue. People would wonder why this guy is still around.
Well, you have to remember that in 10 years he'll be 1986.
So I mean, Wooderson has enough going for him that Slater does not, that makes him makes it okay, you know, socially acceptable for him to be doing what he's doing.
Yeah. But at the same time, though, I love the scenes with Slater. He's such a fun character.
Oh, absolutely.
He's always got something going on. And the fact that, you know, the whole scene with the whole George Washington and the aliens is with Mila Jovovich character, who it's like,
is she beguiling or what? I mean, it's obvious. She's got to be an alien. I mean, she's just, she has DNA that is more than human, you know?
Well, you know, we don't know.
I say
exactly
that with all respect for her mind and accomplishments as an actor. She's bewitching. Wow.
I'll be honest here. I'm a fan of Mila Jovovich for a little of, you know, for the non Resident Evil stuff. Obviously, you know, you have Fifth Element, and you have what we'll definitely be talking about with the Geek Sheet. Probably one of the few people who actually liked The Messenger, where she played Joan of Arc.
It's a tough movie to watch, but not a bad one.
Yeah. But for me, though, it's like this character, considering that she doesn't really say a whole lot, she's pretty quiet, but I mean, like the way that she kind of follows the flame when she has the lighter, the way that she's strumming the guitar and kind of just how she just constantly shows up. She's kind of like the Jeff Goldblum of this cast, going back to Nashville. You know, in Nashville, Jeff Goldblum didn't say a word at all. He didn't say one thing, but he was just so memorable that everything he was doing, you were paying attention to. And that's kind of how it is with Mila Jovovich here, right? She's just constantly is just keeping you entranced with what she's doing and kind of who she's with, and you're always paying attention to what's going on with her, which is kind of sad because, in a way, that should have been what the Joey Lauren Adams character should have been. But yet, I think like the film just kind of forgets her for a little bit, and then she shows up. You know, it's like halfway through the big party. You know, at the water tower, we completely lose where she is. She kind of just disappears.
Yeah, she doesn't really do much.
You know? And considering that she's supposedly Pink's girlfriend, which I completely forgot, you know, by the time we get to the kiss that happens late in the film.
Yeah.
You know, by that particular point, I'd completely forgotten what, you know, what was going on, or that what you know, that they were even together. And then, of course, they're back on the football field, you know, at the very end. But I don't know. The Julia Lauren Adams character, I'll say this is probably the weakest link in this cast. It's the character, not the actors.
Who knows what they filmed in that 3.5 hour cut?
A lot of the deleted scenes have her in it.
Really?
I would recommend, you know, checking that out for that.
Really expand her character and her relation with everybody else?
You have to understand that saying you're expanding a character in a movie like this is... I don't even think that was ever the point. I don't think that this is a movie that was designed to be set up as a character movie. Like with Slacker before it, I think that it was basically you're just kind of following around, checking people out, enjoying kind of a moment with them, and then moving on to doing something else. And if you run into them again, that's cool. If not,
yeah.
Hey, you know, like, did we really want O'Banion to show back up after the paint? You know, we knew that his story was over when he ran off. You know, a conventional movie would have him coming back and he would be like the big bad at the end of the movie. He doesn't show up. Just
kind of there, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, once he got the paint dumped on him, it was time to bow out. You know, and then, of course, we have our other big bad who... Okay, I have a love-hate relationship with Parker Posey.
Yeah.
But holy shit, does she sell the fucking... every scene she's in this movie. Come on. You cannot tell me that this isn't one just the best Parker Posey performance of all time. And say that 5 times fast. Come on.
I mentioned my list of the actors and my other favorite roles of theirs. My other favorite Parker Posey role is... Ian, don't tell me. I knew it when I came in. Josie and the Pussycats.
Okay.
When she's playing deeply insecure boss. So she is at the same time the queen bee, but at the same time she's a former geek deep down inside.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, I mean, to your point, she's the queen bee and she's the boss and she's the alpha female. But there's a humanity there, and it might be an evil, malignant humanity. And as you said, she's just crushing it. She's not acting bad. She is so inhabiting that role that there's nothing fake about it.
That role was so charismatic, and she just sold the shit out of it. I mean, every scene that she's in, like when she, you know, screams like, you know, wipe that face off your head. Lost it. It is not the line, it's the way that she says it that is just so awesome. It was a flub. It was actually supposed to be wipe a smile off your face, and she just completely forgotten. Linklater loved it so much, she said, oh, I'm keeping that. But she's just, her attitude and the fact that, you know, that she's bitchy, but at the same time, just like with O'Banion, there's a humanity to her. There's something that's human about her. And so you kind of, you know, you kind of want her to get a little come up, and she doesn't, you know. But at the same time, though, I'll tell you right now, she's probably going to have the most, in my opinion, my fantasy, she has the worst hangover of everybody at that party. She at least earns like a 2-day hangover, you know, for her trespasses. And don't tell me otherwise. I don't even if like Linklater calls me up and goes, hey, no, she recovered, you know, record time. I'll say, you're a liar, sir. You're a liar. She earns a 2-day hangover, right? But she does have that great scene with Sabrina where, you know, she kind of earns her, you know, she earns that, you know, like, I'm not going to follow you. I'm going to do my own thing. And that's kind of cool. I mean, the way that she stands up to her like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it shows that she, you know, on one hand, she, yeah, has dove into the mainstream, but she's asserting herself, which is how you get somewhere in that kind of environment, by not just, you know, laying down for the alpha people. You have to stand up and be who you are and be somebody, or you will be nobody.
That's true. But what about you, Kent? What do you take of Darla Parker Posey?
Ah, I don't know why she gets into her moods, but
sorry. I have nothing but respect for Parker Posey. It's, the thing is, like,
right.
But she just has the kind of face. She just want to hate her. She just.
I know. She's good at either being a total bitch or sickeningly sweet.
I mean, you know, she is big on the Christopher Guest movies. You know, she was in Waiting for Guffman. She was in Best in Show. If I'm not correct, she was also in Mighty Wind, if I'm not correct.
I believe, well, I just brought up her Deebs, and I think she was.
But, I mean, the thing is she is really gifted. And, you know, and during the 90s, she was considered the queen of the indies because she was practically in everything. You know, she played every kind of role that you could possibly throw at her in the indie scene.
Yeah, she and Marisa Ribisi were in one of my all-time favorite movies, Kicking and Screaming.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know that one.
I have seen that one.
And I just want to go out of my way to prop that movie.
Yeah, Nicole Hoffenhauer. Yeah, I keep getting the director's name wrong, but I know it starts with Hoff. You know, so. No, so put that as you will. But let's talk about the man that we haven't really talked about at all up to this point, which is
Mitch.
Come on,
Mitch.
Oh my god. Okay.
I can't.
Why this actor, Wiley Wiggins, didn't do anything substantial after is. I guess in a way I answered my question because the thing is can you really see him, this actor, doing anything else but this role? I mean, this is, but he plays this role so damn well.
Yeah.
I mean, you want the good things to happen, not to just the character, but the actor. I mean, he, you know, just, you come out of this really liking him, you know.
You're talking about Benny or Mitch?
Mitch.
Okay. Yeah. Mitch. Mitch, Mitch, if you don't know the story about it, Mitch was not an actor and is not an actor now.
No, he's not.
Oh.
Yeah, he's
so you might look at him and think that he's doing some obvious things. Once you're aware of his mannerisms, they're kind of hard to ignore. But he nails it.
Oh yeah, he does. And it's just earnestness and just the way that that all the other actors really kind of bring their best around him, you know, like when he's hanging out with Pink and just their kind of back and forth, you know, that kind of protectiveness that Pink has towards Mitch. Even with how Ben Affleck plays off of him, like in their big scene together, or even like the cute older girl that he so hooks up with at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of those kind of hookups that you kind of like, you have to show some respect, man. That, you know, you did good, my son. Yeah, you did good.
Part of the older guys recognize Mitch as one of them. They recognize him as a future star, you know, so Pink accepts him and takes him under his wing and feels a kinship with him. And I think O'Banion, yeah, resents all the young guys to some degree, but
That's the thing. I think he respects, Mitch after he gets his ass kicked. Because understand, he took one for his friends. And I think O'Banion sees that. You know, that's why after he gets, you know, the pain on him, he doesn't attack Mitch after that. He doesn't, you know, take a retribution for what his friends do. He knows who threw the pain on him. He knows who he hangs out with. But he also knows that guy stood up. And he took his ass beating and he took it like a man. And, you know, so he earned that respect from O'Banion.
He's been initiated. He crossed the line. Now he's in their circle.
Yeah. And I think that that's one of the things that the others see in him. That's one of the reasons why afterwards, you know, even the ones that paddled his ass, you know, afterwards, you know, they were like, all right, you did your, you know, you got your licks. You're one of us, you know, welcome, you know, you've earned it. And, you know, so that's kind of an honorable thing. And the way that Wiley Wiggins really plays off it. Now, we have to talk about the infamous scene of him, which even Richard Linklater wishes that the only regret he ever has is that he completely didn't realize what was happening in the scene. But, you know, that he's just so earnest and so honest and so, you know, likable. Right, that he, in a way, one of the movies that was one of my all-time favorites, but Almost Famous, and how William Miller in that movie had that same kind of earnestness that you just want to see good things happen to him, right?
So, which scene are you talking about?
All right, so the infamous scene is the scene where he is talking to the girl outside the club. The thing is that Wiley is so, the actor is so nervous. He touches his nose 7 times in one scene. And
that's what I'm talking about with the mannerisms. Once you start noticing that,
it's real. It becomes real. Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's, you know, it's funny because it actually is now a meme. It's touch your nose 7 times. But yeah, it made the rounds around the internet. But apparently this, you know, even like at the birth of the internet culture, this was like one of the first memes. And Linklater openly says, man, if I realized what he was doing, and if I was paying attention in the editing bay, I would have either reshot or cut it out or something. It's like that, it's blaring now that it's blatantly a really bad, you know, bad scene. And but at the same time, though, it does have kind of an honestness to it, right? Just it's still kind of sweet.
It's real.
It still earns a spot, in my opinion. Come on, Chris, you gotta admit that's a cute scene. Come on, give me something here, please.
Fuck that, I'm not admitting anything.
Kind of an interesting scene, because who's he talking to during that scene? Isn't he?
He's talking. It was a girl that he had a crush on in middle school. And Payne said, "Oh, why don't you go talk to her?" You know.
Yeah.
And so he does, and he completely strikes out. And then, of course, it's also kind of a setup because Dawn, you know, at the party. Not at the party. It was just before the party. You know, he's the one that's, you know, saying, you know, you go up to her and you don't tell her that you like her. You don't tell her, you know, just giving words of wisdom, right? That that only, you know, high school boys would ever kind of pull. Which, of course, it is actually Don's best scene, too. Because I don't know. Between that and when he tried to hit on the teacher, the way that the teacher shut him down is just awesome. I'm sorry. That was like the other scene that I just bust out laughing. That way that she just pats him on the head like a dog just kills me. It's just that, you know, and he's like coming on hard. He's just total not denied. It's like, you know, you probably would have thought that like, you know, Mutombo was there, you know, not in my house. Sorry.
You always notice with all the rampant everybody wants to make out with everybody else.
It's high school.
Thing. Yeah. Well, you have the one group of incoming freshmen boys that are, we don't see too much, but they're there. And they make this comment about, yeah, we're going to be freshmen. That's where all the girls put out. And like, wait a minute, these are the same girls you're with now. They're the eighth graders. They're just becoming freshmen. You're all moving together.
Mm-hmm.
You're not really talking about going after the older girls. You're talking about the same people, except you're all just going to move up notch. And you're like, we're all going to get laid. No, it's the same.
But the older girls got boobs, man. You know, yeah, they don't have to ones, they don't have to stuff their bras.
But they're not talking about that. They're talking about
Yes, they do. I mean, that was what Carl goes kind of ribs Hirschfelder for, because he was so going to get to second base.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting that out of all those cats, the jocks, Hirschfelder is the one to dance that is clearly close to action.
My God, he was close, dude. I mean, the shit for a high party. My God, it was practically in there.
I can't believe there was a room that was accessible to them that was didn't have an adult sitting in there with a shotgun going. There was?
Yeah.
In that room?
Well, I mean, it was like right outside that room. But
yeah, but he wasn't checking it.
Well, you know, there's only like two of them there, and they have to watch, you know, all the other ones, because, you know, when you're on the dance floor, that's when the real action begins.
You lock that door. You don't let anybody in there.
Well, they probably picked the lock. This is the 70s.
Oh, yeah. Or locks haven't been invented yet. No.
Okay, this isn't like the 1670s.
70s. Actually, those would have been better locks, probably.
Hey, bar the doors.
Yeah.
But actually, I love the fact that it's Hirschfelder that is so close to the action. But I also love the fact that she's actually really sad that he goes, like, you know. Yeah. Like, she's like, she wanted a piece of that action.
Yeah, that's life. Boys better run off and do their dumb shit, you know?
Yeah.
Bros before ladies, right? But, the thing is like, I there's so much about these characters I just enjoy. But, you know, what I also enjoy about this movie, and I think that this is one of the things, this is like one of the first times that I actually saw it firsthand. And, you know, I think that, you know, you talked about it when we were talking about Breakfast Club, the soundtrack. The soundtrack for this movie exploded at the same time that the VHS came out. All of a sudden, this was like one of the top selling soundtracks, so much that they actually had to do a volume 2, if I'm not correct. This actually is one of those that they had to go back and put in even more songs.
Yeah, and these are not cheap songs, you know.
No, in fact,
I want to say the Dylan song is on Volume 2, not 1. So they tried not to spend Bob Dylan money, but they were forced to, and apparently it was worth their while to.
But if I'm not correct, I think that if I'm not correct, it was about 1/6 of the budget was for the rights for the song, for the soundtrack.
Yeah, I wonder what that was. And this is being 96. I mean, soundtracks had not quite taken off the way that they did. Or 93. Sorry, there I go again. But I mean, whatever they paid for it, it must have cost. It must have cost a lot.
Well, I mean, the year after this would be Forrest Gump, and that was another soundtrack that that really kind of that and
yeah, that was like a big chill level type thing.
Yeah.
I mean, like, how many iconic, expensive songs can we fit into this movie? Okay.
Well, the thing is,
classic rock is a real pet subject of mine. I'm writing a book about it right now, in fact. And, you know, it's something that, you know, I contend it is my thesis that classic rock is American folk music. You know, I'm a person of Irish extraction. I didn't come to know Wild Rover until late in my life. You know, I don't know the songs that my forefathers grew up listening to. Mm-hmm. The music that was there as long as I can remember is Hotel California. I don't know a time when Aerosmith's Sweet Emotion was not there. You know, you grow up in America, you know, well, Margaritaville's not the best example.
Well.
But these are the songs you know. These are the songs you grow up with. Even if you don't know how you know them, have you not heard More Than a Feeling, you know?
Yeah.
And for the fact that they are, you know, if you listen to that kind of thing, you can listen to these songs maybe twice a day, every day for 40 years, and they still work. Something about the classic rock canon is magical. You know, it just, it works.
No, I agree. And quite honestly, I think the song picks that they had for this match well with the song, the things that are happening in the film. So it's not like they're just throwing it in there just to have a 70s song. They pick the right song, like with Sweet Emotion. That is just a great damn song to start a movie on. You know, because because especially that the opening of Sweet Emotion has that kind of mellow vibe to it. You know, it builds to that to the crescendo. So that's a great way to kind of fade in, and so you have that kind of going. And then of course, like with the image of a muscle car, a 70s muscle car, you know, and it's kind of doing a victory lap, so to say. I mean, yeah, it's in the parking lot, but it's a victory lap. You know, it's, you know, hey, I got this really kick-ass car. I'm in my teens. I'm on top of the world, you know, and that's just a great song to have with that image. And we have so many of those songs throughout the film that it's, you know, just over and over and over again, it matches what's going on. And like Kiss, I mean, you know, there are so many times that Kiss has been used bad or just thrown there in Detroit Rock City. But no, the thing is that this, you know, they actually use Kiss really well. It works for the scenes that it does. And I also love the fact that, you know, they did kind of throw in the those statues that they make up with the Kiss makeup.
And Mila Jovovich did those, right?
Yeah, she did those. And apparently Gene Simmons loved it so much he bought them. And then he put them up for auction like about 10 years ago.
He probably charged them a lot just to use that.
Yeah. But I probably did it just for the statues. Like, okay, well, once you're done, give me the statues. But no, I love the soundtrack choices, and I want to go back to American Graffiti in that sense, because American Graffiti did the exact same thing with that soundtrack, and I guess I'm the only one that really is very familiar with that movie, unless Kenton, if you're, I don't know how familiar you are, but I also love 50s music as well as classic rock, and the way that they used that same soundtrack and that same kind of, because American Graffiti intended it to be about radio. Wolfman Jack in American Graffiti was a massive character, and when we talk about the movie, and we will at some point talk about American Graffiti, and you are more than welcome to join us for that, Ferris, if you're interested. But Wolfman Jack was a massive character in the movie, and yet for the most part we never saw him. It was his voice that was, you know, kind of being our guide through this movie. And here, while we don't have a radio DJ, what we do have is, I guess, what I'll call the 8-track kind of vibe. Throw on some tunes. Let's, you know, you can hear it off the car radio, but it's not from the radio. It's from, or the car stereo. It's, it, you know, it's being played on the 8-track. It's, you know, it's from someone's private collection kind of thing. Right? Or at least that's kind of how I kind of took it. Was there even 8-track in 76? I want to say there was 8-track in 76.
Yes.
Okay. Just want to make sure.
It's popular music. I mean, it's what was in the air. It's what everybody was listening to. It's what was the new hotness of the day.
Yeah. And again, we're talking about Texas. You know, this is, I mean, you know, whenever people think about Texas, they're not thinking about rock. They're, you know, unless, you know, you're from Austin, you know, we have the best rockers in the world. But, just saying. They all come to Texas. But again, that's the thing, is like, you know, the soundtrack just plays every scene, and it's just well orchestrated, well in tune. It, you know, the variety of music that is thrown out there, it's not playing just off of like Black Sabbath. You have Black Sabbath, but it's not just that. It's, you know, it plays all of it. You know, it just it's just this hodgepodge of 70s and I think even like late 60s work, if I'm not correct. There are some late 60s tracks as well. That's kind of what I appreciate about the soundtrack in that sense. But what about you, Kent? What are your thoughts about the soundtrack?
I couldn't believe that some of these songs actually existed in 76. I thought they were later songs, which freaks me out because
there might be one or two that were, you know, past 76, but I don't think there's that many.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure if there were, Ferris would have mentioned it. It's like, that's historically inaccurate. But, right?
Chris, you did like the music, right?
Yeah.
Oh.
Because what were they playing at the dance? That was.
Chris, I got to get something out of him. Yeah. Chris, would you agree that the Mila Jovovich is photogenic? Guys, help me out here. We got to get some kind of positive comment out of him.
Not really.
I think.
Would you agree that Sweet Emotion is a song by the rock band Aerosmith?
Does it what?
So even the music is not up to snuff.
It's okay, I guess.
Would you agree that Richard Linklater went on to direct other movies?
Yes, I would agree. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
I'll settle for that.
I'm going to make sure that we do all of them at some point.
Oh, yay.
You know, I'm...
Give me a chance to defend that.
You
Bears.
Look close enough. I bet Julie Delpy is in here somewhere.
Well, that was the thing. I honestly thought that Christina Anarosa was Julie Delpy, but I had to remind myself, wait a second, she's French. What does she do in Texas? But for the longest time, throughout the film, the first time I saw it, I thought that was Julie Delpy.
I bet she's in here somewhere. I have no evidence to suggest that she would be, and it doesn't make any sense, but... retrospect, there's no way she can't be.
Now, just bear in mind, though, that it was only a year later that he would make Before Sunrise. So, just saying.
Okay.
Just saying. But, oh, man. I guess we will be doing the Before trilogy at some point.
Yes,
and three times yes. But, all right, we've talked about the soundtrack. We talked about the acting. What do we think about the pacing of the film? Did you kind of like the kind of on the breeze vibe that the film does? Do you think it's kind of too scattershot? Chris, I'm going to let you go off because this is a great chance for you to throw out some more of your hate.
Let's hear the rant.
What fucking pacing, man? Oh my God. It was all over the place and just the side of ugh.
I'm just going to quote you on that. I'm going to put it everywhere on the advertising for this episode.
Yeah.
Chris.
Yeah. I'm okay with this. That's okay, yeah.
Oh, boy. What about you? What about you, Kent?
Some of the pacing seemed slow. I was able to split it into three distinct acts in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the end of the school day through sunset, the party, and then the after party events. And you can set it up as that's easier to understand what's going on if you think about it as the characters are doing this now at this time of day. These guys, by the end of the film have been up almost 24 hours because nobody takes a nap. So I'm actually amazed they're as conscious as they are.
You don't sleep on the last day of school.
Some people do. So, or because you party that Saturday, it's like you arranged what you're going to do for the summer. And then you just, I'm going to rest now. Then I'm going to be partying. And the 70s. They were like so different, man.
What about you, Ferris? What do you think about the pacing?
I like it. I think this movie is one of those that is infinitely rewatchable. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the scenes, while not classically constructed, are scenes. You know, there's a scene and something happens. I think, you know, as my immediate experience with it proves to me, at least, you can turn it on at any given point. You know, if it's on cable, boom, flip that on and you can watch for a while and you're not going to be confused. You can, you're not going to be in the middle of a long segment that's going to leave you lost. I mean, you're going to move on to another scene pretty quickly and it will be something decent, you know? So I think it works.
There's a lot of vignettes here. And in a way, this is kind of the vibe.
Good word
that,
for it.
Yeah. But the thing is like, I go back to Slacker because Slacker kind of has this same vibe and where, you know, you have something that happens and then we move on to something else. And I love that kind of honor breeze. I love the fact that we have basically 20 major characters, or 10 major characters, 20 or 10 supporting characters. So 20 characters that you're pretty much following around. And they all have something that's going on. Now, to the level of how important it is to the story, most of it isn't important. And I think that that's kind of the intention of the film, is that it's the last day of school. No one really has much going on. The only big decision that has to be made is who's going to show up at the party and will Pink sign the paper. And I don't, and even the film doesn't really care about that decision a whole lot because it just kind of like throws that there. Okay, well, are you going to sign or not? I don't know. Okay, we'll get to it later. Are you going to sign the paper? I don't know. All right, we'll get to it later. And then he'll finally decide at the end. And basically, and on top of but what I like about that is the fact that throughout the film, it does kind of give you these other characters that are basically deciding, okay, you know what? I'm not going to play by the rules that I'm told that I'm supposed to play by. And then, you know, so when he decides, oh, I'm not going to play by your rules, well, it makes sense because everyone else is basically doing the same thing. You know, it's not out of character for this group of kids. And it's just that all the characters are, and I know that I'm going to hear it from Chris, but all the characters are interesting. There's something going on. There's something about them. There's character development, even if it's one of those things where they're not doing anything to really develop character. They're talking about what's happening. They're talking, they're waiting for things to happen, which is kind of how a high school would be, especially in a small town. You can't do anything but just hang out with your friends, get drunk or get high or, you know, do something, you know, just something menial while you're waiting for your life to begin. And I think that that's kind of what the film is kind of getting at in that sense. And I don't know, I find myself drawn by these characters, fascinated by these characters. I wanted to know more about these characters. I would have loved to have gone another 24 hours, the 24 hours after this movie. What were they doing the day after? You know, after they've gotten over their hangovers and
sleep. Yeah.
But at the same time, though, that's, in my opinion, a sign of a great movie. It's like when the movie's over and you find yourself wanting to know what happens next. Where are these characters going to go? What's going to be the next step? What is going to be the first day of school?
Yeah, so tangent from there, Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some is clearly a sequel, even though for whatever reasons it is not directly. Well, it is obviously a sequel about Mitch Kramer leaving home and going to college, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And it has the same vibe. I will say my only big problem with Everyone Wants Some is it just doesn't have the same dirty look that Dazed and Confused has. It has a little bit of a cleaner, and I think maybe it's just the fact that it was shot in digital that it kind of has that. But other than that, though, yeah, it's completely I don't know if it's an official sequel. I don't know if Linklater said that it was, you know, that he intended as an official sequel to Dazed and Confused, but it definitely has the same kind of how do I put it?
If you would take the biggest fan of Dazed and Confused in the world and say this movie is about Mitch Kramer driving to college and this is his first day at college, mm-hmm. the person might be slightly confused that they're not calling him Mitch, but they would figure it out.
Pretty much. And
it would not feel inauthentic, I guess.
My friend Caesar, who's been on the show several times now, he's a huge fan of Dazed and Confused, and that's exactly how I felt about Everybody Wants Some. And quite honestly, I want to agree, but I guess for me, it's like I just wish that it felt like it was in the same universe. I think that's my only problem, is that it just feels too damn clean. That's one of the reasons why I didn't put it on any of my lists, is because it was just too clean for a movie about the 80s. You know, none of that sounds really weird now that I think about it, but I still feel that way. So,
well, you got to remember the 80s were bitching.
That they were. But there was a lot of great humor, a lot of great comedy in Everybody Wants Some. At some point, maybe we'll talk about that, because we will be talking about all of Richard Linklater's work. All of Richard Linklater, all of Alfred Hitchcock, we're going to hit it all. That's, 200 episodes right there. So we're going to be around until 2030 at least.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, yeah, clear calendars, gentlemen. We're sticking around for a bit. But
guys, I got to get running here. Yes. I don't know if you want to edit me out or
tie this up. I think we've pretty much hit all the big parts. Ken, do you want to go do a quick geek sheet?
Mira Jovovich, Fifth Element, and Resident Evil stuff. Joy, Lauren Adams, the Kevin Smith verse.
Would you
Batman.
Got a lot of action stars in this.
Yeah,
but Matthew, to look at Mila Jovovich, would you guess in a million years
that she would go on to
one of the amazing action stars of her age?
Not out of this cast. I wouldn't look and go, there's no action star. I wouldn't even say there's an action star period anywhere in this cast.
And yet Affleck, of course, is the best film Batman since Adam West, R.I.P.
Yeah. Wait, the best film Batman ever? No, that's animated. Mask of the Phantasm was in theaters, so okay.
That's true. That is true.
Yes, to that. So.
Yeah, Cole Hauser's an actor I think never quite got his due. I know he's had a good career, but once he stopped playing this kind of role, I didn't buy him as an action guy as much.
What, you didn't like him as Johns in Pitch Black?
Nah, I like him as the blue-collar, earthy guy. I'm a huge Good Will Hunting fan. He plays Bill in there, and I like him.
With Ben Affleck?
Stoic. Yeah. You know, it's a Samson-like effect that, you know, he changed his hair and things were never the same.
Well, let me just put it this way. So, let's see. Jason Lynn and Joy Lord Adams were both in Mallrats, along with Ben Affleck. Anthony Rapp and Adam Goldberg were in A Beautiful Mind together. By the way, Anthony Rapp, the original, I forgot what the character, Mark, original Mark from Rent, by the way. Let's see here. We have... Ben Affleck.
Yeah, somebody I was. I never knew this. Siobhan, the girlfriend of Dawn, is the cocktail waitress from Swingers.
Yeah, that's her.
We're not in Kansas anymore. That's her, Dina Martin.
That's true. Yep. Let's see. I'm just going to quickly throw out a few ones. Nikki Catt, Ben Affleck were in Boiler Room together. Let's see. We have. Adam Goldberg was in Saving Private Ryan with who was it? He was in there with one of the bigger names.
Matt Damon. And he went on to create the Goldbergs.
Yeah,
Was it Adam Goldberg that was the focal?
No, it's
different.
Adam F. Goldberg. They had
Ron Goldberg.
Okay,
but anyhow.
All right. Well, okay. Let's go ahead and let's just call it. We have a whole bunch. We'll probably get to at some point later.
Oh, Michelle Burke. This isn't really another acting thing, but she was Connie Conehead. Mitch's older sister, Jody. She was Connie Conehead in the Coneheads movie, which is a mesmerizing, very rewatchable movie. Underrated.
Whoa. That sounds like a future debate.
No, it's good. It's not a classic. It's not the kind of thing that'll grab you the first time. Very watchable movie.
Mm.
We'll talk about that later.
All right. Yeah. Also, well, gentlemen, also, let's go ahead and let's call it. It's been a little late. So, Kent, Chris, Ferris, do you
Chris,
agree with the critics?
At very least, Chris, do you understand why this movie is a thing?
I understand, and it doesn't, not with me, I guess. I mean, I understand the appeal to a certain degree.
Yes. Who did you dislike least?
Least. Well, now that's going to take a whole other podcast to figure out. So.
Oh, wow.
But at no point in this did you look at anybody and think, she's okay, he's okay.
Not offhand.
And if the answer is no, it's no. I'm trying to.
I'm pretty sure.
Feel out the and plumb the depths of your antipathy for this flick.
Oh, I actually had something to add. It was actually Jeremy London in Mallrats, not Jason London.
They're
twins.
Yeah,
that's right.
I mix them up all the time too, so it's crazy.
They all look the same,
right?
Yeah. White people,
white guys.
In order to, I'll just go ahead and I'll say it. All right. So let's go ahead and do this. Kent, Chris, and Ferris, do you agree with the critics on Days of Confused? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail, or a maybe? Ferris,
I give it a pass. You know, IMDb has it at a 7.7. That's criminally criminally low. What kind of egghead would give it a 7.7? You don't deserve movies. Metacritic has it at a 78. That's also low. Rotten Tomatoes, 94. That sounds about right to me. I would give it something like closer to 100. But 94, I can see that.
Yeah?
Certainly a pass. Certainly a pass.
All right. Chris?
I do not agree with the critics. I don't know if I was born in the 80s. I don't know if that's something to do with it. It didn't connect with me at all. And it's a fail for me.
Have you seen Can't Hardly Wait?
Careful, you might get ganged up on this sometime. One. You just let you know. This is probably the best time to lie. I'm kidding. That's all right.
Oh.
Kent, what about you?
Well, I have to, I'm probably going to get a little bit of hate. I don't love this movie. I can't find myself to go, this movie is so fantastic, but I don't have any real hatred for it at all. It's just kind of, yes, it's well done. Everybody did their parts well, and everything is there, but for some reason it never clicked and seriously dug in and engaged and made me go, yes, I am so excited for this film. But I can't find anything wrong with it. At the same time, it's like the only thing wrong with it that I could think of is me. So it's not engaging with me, which is my fault. But at the same time, that means I can't yell.
You aren't feeling it.
I'm not gonna fail it though. No, I don't have that visceral not good movie. It's like no, in some ways I could see its appeal to people who idolize the 70s and go, yeah, 70s, that's when I should have been lived. And like, that's when I should have been born. No, if you were born in the 70s, you'd be 6 years old in 1976. No. Okay. Roll it back. Okay. So, I'm maybeing it for reasons, but.
All right.
And I know where you're going, so...
All right, well, I won't to drag this out too much. I'll just say I'm not a fan of the 70s other than the movies. I am not a part of the stoner culture. I've never smoked weed in my life. And I love this movie. And I love it because I am fascinated by the characters. I love the vibe. I love the music. I love the setting, the staging, the presentation of the film. I feel for the characters. I... just when I watch this movie, I have a smile on my face and I feel good when I watch this movie. And it's one of those things, like, I can defend the film, not just because it makes me feel good, because it really gives you characters that you can really sink your teeth into, that you can really get involved in. And which is weird because they also didn't do a whole lot. But they're very fascinating. And that's something that I find very interesting about this movie. And this was this was after I kind of come to see Richard Linklater, but this was before I became a fan of Richard Linklater, which came, I want to say, after I saw the Before Midnight. And I think that was really the point where I fell in love with him. But here, though, it's got a great vibe. I love this movie. I recommend this. And I have a feeling this is one of those movies that is going to find revival every 20 years. So it's about time for that revival. Just letting you know. But, you know, I can't recommend this movie enough. So shame on you, Chris. But that's okay. We'll call this your revenge for La La Land.
Well, it is my personal rule that, you know, again, with my 15% margin of error, I think your average person, pretty much everybody, myself included, certainly, your taste is going to be 85% correct at best. Yeah, I know a couple people that are closer to 95, 99, but me, yeah, maybe 85. So
I get you. All right, but next week we are going to be tackling a big, big movie, one of the big ones, the monsters, the ones that it's surprising me that we haven't touched just yet. Ken, do you want to give us a rundown?
Well, there are a couple of different movies we were discussing, but this involved a big object, right?
Something black.
Whoa.
Rectangular.
Rectangular. Okay. actually, a pair of them, but one's significantly bigger than the other.
Oh my god, the end of the year. This is getting interesting.
Okay.
Right, so what is it?
2001 Space Odyssey.
And we're trying to line up a pretty awesome guest for that, so we'll let you know more as we get that. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. Where can people find you on the internet, Ferris?
Me, quickest way, you can check me on Twitter. I spend way too much time there. Twitter/DXFerris is the easiest way to my bullshit. If you want to check out a sort of omnibus of my bullshit, you can go to checkoutmybutt.com.
Nice. And, of course, if you want to throw us a few comments our way, if you want to chastise Chris for hating what is basically an American classic.
Bring it, man. Fucking bring it.
You can definitely throw those comments our way at our Facebook page or on Twitter at Arthouse Legends. Or if you want to be quiet about it, you can always do the email thing, arthouselegends@gmail.com. And of course, if you love our show, go on to iTunes, give us that 5-star review. We would love it deeply. Thank you so much.
It's a big help.
But thank you so much, Ferris, for joining us. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Kent.
This is Chris.
This is Ferris. Thank you for listening.
And Fiend.